You are listening to OBR.FM. This is Theology in Action, where we talk about the intersections of spirituality, religion, and social justice. I'm your host, David Concepcion. Welcome. And we are going to be talking tonight about the Israeli and Palestinian conflict with two longtime peace activists, John Roberts and Martin Fetterman. The conflict between Israelis and Palestinians in the Middle East seems to many to be an ongoing and never-ending struggle. The fragility of the ceasefires are often directly inverse to the level of violence in the conflict. Many international leaders have tried and failed to broker peace between the two sides, and each time it falters, the hardliners seem to emerge revitalized, and the likelihood of a satisfying accord between the two slips further and further away. Still, activists who fight for the cause are not relenting. Activists for Israeli and Palestinian rights have joined together to speak out with one voice against violations of human rights and for a lasting and sustained peace in the region. Tonight we speak with two of them working towards this goal. Martin Fetterman works with the Jewish Voice for Peace in Boston and is the co-chair of the American Jews for Just Peace in Boston. John Roberts works with the Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights, which also Martin is with. And John also hosts a radio show called This Week in Palestine, which can be heard at 8 a.m. on WZBC 90.3 FM. And they are both members of the Cambridge Bethlehem People to People Project. I'd like to welcome you both to the show.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Thank you. So tell us first a little bit about the organization that you're both involved with, the Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights and the Cambridge Bethlehem People to People Project.
Well, Cambridge Bethlehem People to People Project started about, really we began organizing about 2006 with contacts that we had in Bethlehem. We wanted to create a kind of project that linked people from Cambridge with people from Bethlehem in a kind of a sister city project, which Cambridge has. Cambridge has a number of sister city
yes.
Relationships that are sort of official in that the municipality, the city council, and the mayor and everyone sort of gets behind it. We didn't go that route. We created it without trying to get official recognition because we knew of the difficulty we might have with people opposing that, and that we would then get into a kind of a struggle that we didn't want to get into because we really wanted to forge relationships with people in Bethlehem. So we started, and we sent a delegation of, I think, 15 people in 2007 to Bethlehem, meeting with the mayor and the city council, municipality in Bethlehem, with cooperatives, with folks at Bethlehem University, with NGOs, with a number of people, you know, working for a just solution to the Israeli Palestinian conflict, and we were there 10 days, I think, right. Something like that, meeting with three or four people a day, hospitals, schools, attempting to begin to forge these relationships, and must say have been successful in that. We've not only had people go to Bethlehem, in fact, we have one person over there right now, but we've brought people from Bethlehem here, and particularly a theatrical group out of the Ida refugee camp, an organization called Al Ruwad that has an incredibly good program of theater and dance with young people. And we brought them over in 2009, and they appeared at the Central Square Theater in Cambridge, the Atlantic Theater off Broadway. They did their dramatic presentation at on Cape Cod in Truro and also in Connecticut, Old Saybrook, Connecticut, and in Vermont, so that they had a number of presentations throughout the Northeast. Yeah. And then the kids worked for a week with students in Cambridge in a summer program doing theater workshop for a week. And we've also hosted a photographic exhibit where photographers in Bethlehem took pictures in Bethlehem that were from the exact position of pictures that we found in the Aga Khan collection at Harvard University of old Bethlehem.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, and so we had these photographs from the early 19th century, and we had the photographers identify where they were, and then went and took pictures. And some of them were quite dramatic, because you would have a wonderful picture of Rachel's tomb, mm-hmm. and now you see the wall. That's all you see.
Wow.
Is the wall, and so it was quite dramatic. And we are planning for another exhibit that will be just a year from now. It will be in Cambridge. That is going to feature Palestinians in Cambridge, sort of in the diaspora, and their stories.
Right. Okay.
So anyway, that's a quick snapshot of Cambridge people to people.
Yeah, I would just want to add to that you know, before we started, you said something about what keeps us doing this. One of the things that we have found through this connection with Bethlehem, Bethlehem is long walking distance, which I know from having lived there many years ago and having walked it from Jerusalem, has now been completely cut off from Jerusalem. The wall not only surrounds a good part of Bethlehem, but snakes within it. There are separating people from fields, separating communities from communities, students from their schools. It's horrific. The economy has been horribly devastated, and I could go on, but the amazing thing that we found is the incredible amount of resilience. In working with the kids from Al Ruwad at the Ida camp, and the things that they're doing, and this sense of even along with anger at what the occupation means and what's happening, this sense of we're just not going to be put down by this, that we're going to keep going on. And so it's just...
It's a form of resistance. In fact, they call it the beautiful resistance, that doing drama, doing dance, even becoming educated. It's interesting that in Palestine, in this land that's occupied, the per capita number of PhDs is extremely high, higher than the United States, higher than Israel. I mean, people study, and they often don't have anything to do then.
As a form of defiance, you think?
Yes. And they are going to live their lives, and they're going to look for the day when they'll be able to achieve their goals. The fellow that runs the Al Ruwad Theater has a PhD in microbiology.
Yeah.
That he got from France. Now, there's not much work for microbiologists, but Abed is at heart a theater person, mm-hmm. anyway. So he's fulfilling his dream, but it's not in microbiology. It's through the work with these kids at Al Ruwad.
Going in the right direction, I guess. You're following your heart. That's the way to go. One thing I guess I'd like to ask, let's get right to some of the heart of. I guess the conflict. What is something that you would like, I guess, our listeners and people to know that we don't know from like the regular mainstream media, or we don't see often in the mainstream media? And I'll start with Martin first.
Boy, there's so much. I guess the first thing that comes to mind is that we really don't have any sense here of not just what Palestinians and Israelis think about each other, but about how successful Israeli policy, the wall, the occupation itself has kept people apart so that there are stereotypes that are created. The institutional Jewish community here in the United States magnifies that, and it short circuits the ability for people to see each other as people and go to some resolution. It's fascinating what you hear from both Israelis and Palestinians in some areas. You say, what do you want? And it's played out, obviously, very differently. But basically, they're saying, we just want this to end. We want to live normal lives. The Israelis in Tel Aviv just want to be able to go to a cafe and feel okay and nothing's going on. And Palestinians want to send their kids to school and not have to go through checkpoints and, you know, see their families and live a normal life. And but the perception that we get here is based on the stereotypes of Palestinian terrorists, suicide bombers. There's an effort to keep those visions, those images constantly there, so in order to justify so that Israeli policy is always based on security.
Right.
When you look into it, the reality is, for instance, the wall was never built for security. It has had very little effect on security. What it's done is it's stolen lots of land from Palestinians, and it's kept Palestinians and Israelis apart to a large extent in order to keep up that sense of the other. When first went on the delegation we were in 2001, I was horrified to see on dumpsters a Jewish star equals swastika. And as a Jew and a Jewish educator, that just was incredibly awful to me.
Mm-hmm.
And after being there a while, I started to realize that the only people that many Palestinians ever see are soldiers at checkpoints or coming into their homes in the middle of the night with bizarre justification. And it's hard to imagine. It always amazes me when I'm in Palestine and I hear people, and I'm not naive, but I think that overwhelmingly it's sincere that Palestinians still are able to say, we don't hate Jews. We don't even hate Israelis. We hate the occupation. We hate the... But that's the only image they have, and that's what they live with.
Interesting.
Israelis, on the other hand, have been kept apart. And, I have very close friends there. I talk to them. I tell them what I've seen in the West Bank. And they say, well, we know it's problematic. For a long time, the word was inconvenient. We know the occupation is inconvenient for them. But, if they didn't do this, if they weren't suicide bombers, if they weren't terrorists, if they would talk to us, because that's what they're fed, then they don't know. I don't want to overstate that in terms of how many people do know and just, choose not to deal with it. That's a whole interaction that I think just perpetuates this.
Largely, there's a narrative. There are two narratives. An Israeli Zionist narrative. There is a Palestinian narrative. And the narrative that we're fed is mostly the Israeli narrative, which is based on mythology.
Okay.
It is based on the fact that or the perception that somehow Jews came from Europe and other places to a land that was largely not inhabited, that was given to them by God, and they made this land bloom, this desert, which
right.
was a banded desert, that kind of thing. And I think a lot of the work that we try to do is to try to tell the truth about what really happened.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what really, in 1948, mm-hmm. when the Israeli state was declared, when after fierce fighting,
right,
largely by Israeli militias that had built themselves into, you know, the equivalent of an army, while
right.
the Arab, the Palestinians did not. Mm-hmm. But at that point in history, Jews were 30% of the population and owned 6% of the land.
Mm-hmm.
6% of the land. And so in 1948, they drove out over 750,000 Palestinians, destroyed over 350 of their villages, just destroyed their villages and drove them out. And that's the Palestinian narrative. Now, the Palestinian narrative is this is our land, too. And we want our land and we have a right to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their struggle. That's really their struggle. And they have, supposedly, they would have 22% of the land, the West Bank and Gaza, supposedly. But Israel continues to take even that land.
Right.
And you, we talk about the peace process, and we can talk about the peace process, but it's basically been a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Because from the beginning, I think, and we can talk about this, but going all the way back to the founding of Zionism in 1897 or so,
right.
The goal has been the land,
mm-hmm.
to have the land from the Mediterranean to the river. Now, a lot of us think, well, that's the Jordan River, but there are Zionists that also believe it's Iraq. It goes beyond Iraq. Anyway,
oh, wow.
If you go back and look at the peace process, Israel has refused really to talk about any kind of borders or to set any kind of concrete limits on their ability to control Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
And so each stage of the peace process, whether it's Oslo or whatever it is, it's bought time. And during that time, they continue to take the land. During Oslo, there were how many? Less than 100,000 settlers.
Something like that.
Yeah, it was maybe 60,000 settlers and settlements in the West Bank.
And then
Oslo, when we thought, "Oh, this is really the beginning," during this period of time, now it's well over 250,000.
Yeah, I remember the buildup.
That's right, 250,000 into Palestinian land. Now they're taking East Jerusalem, and so to me, the peace there has been no peace process. It has simply been an attempt to buy time, to buy the status quo, in order to continue the process of taking the land. And the resistance on the other side is, this is our land. We can share the land, but there has to be equality. There has to be rights. In order to do this, and that simply has not been part of the equation.
I'm going to go back a little bit to 1912 is like when they were talking about a kind of a two-state solution then as two. But at the time, Palestinians were owning the land, and it was the Jews that were trying to talk. They were talking about sharing land, trying not
well,
to integrate
the,
in
the
European Jews, right?
Yeah, the United Nations in 1947 came up with what they called the partition plan,
right?
And in which, again, this is 1947,
mm-hmm.
in which, again, those figures that I gave before were just about right. Maybe mm-hmm. Jews only 5 or 6% of the land, and maybe 30% of the population. But the UN said, we're going to cut the land in half. They, mm-hmm. I mean, they were going to give Palestinians 48% and Israel 52% of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And people wondered, why didn't they take, what a deal. Why wouldn't they take that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've got to ask yourself, if you're the United States, or even if you're Israel, if you were 30%, if you were 70% of the population and you owned 94% of the land, and someone came in and said, hey, let's cut the land in half, is that a good deal for you?
Right.
No, they didn't take that deal. Now you look at, they have less than 22%, and if they'd only taken the deal. But no one in their right mind, would agree to give their land away
right.
under such circumstances.
Let me to correct one thing that John said, talking about the land, going for the land, starting at the end of the 19th century. The reality is that the Rothschild family, who were fantastically wealthy in three or four different countries in Great Britain and France, were already in the mid-19th century beginning to buy land with the idea that eventually more and more Jews would be able to go and settle there. So it was just a solidification in the Zionist congresses to pursue that. And if you look at the documentation, there isn't even a whole lot of denying that. The company that was buying up land and I can't remember the exact name, but it was the Palestine Colonization Committee. That's what they talked about. Ben Gurion, who I grew up in a very Zionist home, and Ben Gurion was we used to joke that when God had problems, he called Ben Gurion for advice. He was a god. And, we now know that Ben-Gurion was saying, wasn't getting publicized. I guess you could say he was a little bit more compassionate than some. He said, it's too bad, but we have to get rid of all of the Arabs because that's the only way we're going to be able to solidify a Jewish state. So that's always been there. The other point I want to make is, and this goes directly to what John was talking about in terms of, would you accept that deal? Israeli leaders, Ariel Sharon was the absolute best at this, and Netanyahu is to a large extent, but I'm hoping he's gone so crazy that people will start to finally realize. But Sharon and others were incredibly adept at moving 10 steps. And if there started to finally be some pushback from the world, he said, oh, okay, we'll compromise. And he pulled back 2 steps. And what we got in the news is, look, Sharon's trying to be to compromise and be conciliatory. And nobody thinks about how the lines have already been moved tremendously. Oh. And that's where we start to, to negotiate.
Right.
Yeah.
The metaphor I use is your neighbor comes and takes 3/4 of your backyard, mm-hmm. and you have a struggle. And then the neighbor says, okay, we have it on. Let's compromise. So you lose. I mean, any compromise, once the land has been taken, you lose. There is no compromise to this. The asymmetry to this struggle is just incredible.
It's sort of really out of balance, because 10 years ago they were talking about the whole let's make have a 2-state solution. If you try to do that now, it looks like Swiss cheese.
In the early 1980s, mm-hmm. Israel opened its archives. It revealed a lot of the documents out of the period of time for the founding of Israel, and it was the diary of Ben Gurion, and it was a military document, all kinds of new information from the Irgun, from the militias, from the Stern Gang, from Haganah, that were carrying this struggle, and. There's a group of historians called the New Historians that are writing history from these archives that just absolutely blow apart the Israeli narrative of what went on. Ilan Pappe, Avi Shlaim, Benny Morris, a number of them. And my feeling is, what I would love to have to do is just have people read that. If Israelis would read that. Now, they think these historians are probably wild-eyed, pro-Arab, whatever, but the documentation is incredible. Mm-hmm. And particularly Ilan Pappe. And what's happening now is the archives were opened on the war on 1967. And that's been opened up. And they are just been available for maybe 3 years now. And Alain Pape is writing a book on this. And a lot of the same kind of material he's finding, that the mythology around what happened in 1967 is just like the mythology around 1948. And so we're going to have this new historian, and hopefully there'll be others that'll go in there and write also about what's going on. But it's, so much of it, of what Israelis believe and what people in the United States believe, because that's what they've been told, is just sheer mythology.
Okay. I should just point out that some of these new historians, like Pape, would be considered to be pretty far to the left. But there are others like Benny Morris who are clearly not.
No.
These are people that rejected a lot of this initially and just can't anymore.
Okay.
And they're making rationalizations.
The conclusions are different. Benny Morris, who's a very conservative, we would call him a right-winger, I suppose.
Right.
He documents the fact that there were 750,000 refugees, driven out, that there were the destruction of the 350-plus villages. He documents all of that the way Pape and Schlaim and the others do. But then he says, that's the price you pay. No. We had to pay, you have to break some eggs to make an omelet type thing. And other people read it and say, where the hell is justice, and then you get into what the international community and the Geneva Accords and the United Nations and all the international law that's being that's being broken here, and we shake our heads because it's the United States and Israel that are calling the tune, and when Israel has a big brother like the United States, that's all it needs. Unfortunately, that's all it needs.
So what do you do to kind of break this narrative down, or what do you do to kind of like get people to see that the narrative that they've been listening to is wrong, change the mythology, and maybe change course of the process?
That's a great question, and there's no easy answer to that. I think that certainly one of the things that I have been working with, and sometimes incredibly frustratingly, I come from a Jewish perspective. A good deal of my work, as you pointed out, is with Jewish Voice for Peace and American Jews for Just Peace. And that's been the hardest thing to crack, is to break through. So many of us grew up with these myths, they were never questioned. When I lived in Israel between undergraduate and graduate school, I interacted all the time with Arabs. We never called them Palestinians at the time. And for years after that, it took incredible process for me to understand how much of that, of what was going on, was based on that mythology. To say to the average Jew, who probably isn't thinking very deeply about these things, step back and look at some of the reality. And what we're working against is an incredibly well-funded propaganda machine from Israel, from the institutional Jewish community, that has virtually endless resources to continue to hammer away on the one hand of this mythology. We deserve this land. God gave it to us. After the Holocaust, we have to protect ourselves. At the same time, this, what I mentioned earlier, this sense of security. If we don't do these things, it's going to be another Holocaust. I'll just throw in, that's one of the great ironies, is that the institutional Jewish leadership in Israel has worked incredibly hard to destroy the memory of the world that was lost in the Holocaust. They thought those people were too weak. They walked into the gas chambers and didn't fight back, except for a handful. Yiddish, that whole environment was terrible. Let's get rid of it. People didn't want to see people talking Yiddish. And simultaneously, they have latched on to this Holocaust image. And I want to be clear, in case anyone's listening, I think the Holocaust needs to be remembered, and I'm not talking anything about that.
Absolutely.
But the way in which it's been misused to say, we can do all of these things because look what the world did to us, and we don't want the world to do this to us again, and it's totally not the reality.
You ask what can be done, because at the base of this, this is a human rights issue. This
of course,
is a
absolutely.
Civil rights issue. This is the we're talking about really, really great injustices that we all know about injustice. We know what happened to black people in this country. We know that at our heart. So, you know, my hope is not only that people read the new narrative, but that they read the prophets. you look at Judaism. I spent a good portion of my life at one point, studying the Old Testament and reading the prophets. And even in Hebrew, I did. I couldn't give you a word of Hebrew today. But and the same with Christians, I think. It's the same with Christians. Okay. The Christian church is just not involved in this issue. It's very different. Marty and I have worked together to try to penetrate some of the Christian churches in Cambridge to get them on this issue. But it's very difficult because of the ecumenical movement where, Jews and Christians are working together around housing issues like in Boston. And so the Christians say, well, we can't offend our Jewish brothers and sisters, but it's this struggle. Mm-hmm. But I think we have to say to Jews and to Christians and to whoever will listen, look, read the prophets, read the Old Testament, read the New Testament if you're Christian, and then tell me that what's going on in Israel and Palestine today isn't one of the great injustices being perpetrated on Mother Earth today. Just look at it and tell me that this isn't a great injustice, and then what are you going to do about it? I mean, I think that's
key. Yeah.
Here's an example. When some churches started talking about not initially divesting from Israeli companies, but looking into their investments and thinking about whether they wanted to have investments in companies that supplied or supported the occupation. The institutional Jewish community here immediately came out with this thing that you hear over and over again. They were attacked and told, you're undermining the historic relationship between Christians and Jews. Mm. Now, I always immediately think of what the relationship is. Is that the relationship that goes back to the Crusades? Putting that aside, the reality is that, as John was saying, a lot of the churches, for perfectly good reasons, because of their caring about the relationship with Jews, really got bullied by that. Mm-hmm. And some of us, Jewish Voice for Peace in Boston, has now for some time been working on developing joint kinds of programming with some of the churches, particularly the Unitarian Universalists are trying to, there are a couple of churches that have been doing some things, and they're trying to kind of bring that together regionally. And I've been saying to them that, been challenging them to say, you can't respond to what you're being told. What you need to be doing is being very assertive and saying, we won't let you bully us. We're not doing anything new. This isn't an issue of anti-Semitism. It's not an issue even of anti-Israel. This is an issue of what we've been doing all along. And I think John just said it. I mean, churches have said for generations, we're not going to invest in tobacco companies. We're not going to invest in companies that make guns. And now they're applying it in a way that goes precisely along with what they're what they've been saying all along.
It's like not investing in not trying to invest in oppression, but at the same time trying to resist the bullying. That's you know,
that's right.
That would be the next question in the same thing. How, finding the narrative, but also how do you fight against that bullying aspect, or fight against the fear mongering that goes into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
I keep going back to the same thing about we have to go back to our roots on this. I think if you're talking about the church, or you're talking about the synagogue, going back to the roots of this, because that's where the narrative begins. I mean, if you say to Christians, look, you've got to understand, Jesus lived under occupation. The Romans occupied, and he stood against the Roman occupation. And then there was the institutional synagogue. And he stood against the institutional synagogue because they were concerned about money and ceremony, and they weren't concerned about justice. And that's what the guy was all about. Mm-hmm. Or the Jews, you know, what were the prophets all about? The prophets kept trying to tell the king, look, this is the real deal, you know? And so in terms of the religious community, I think we have to call them to be, you know, to be faithful to their roots and to the prophetic of documents that define who they are.
Your prophetic voice.
Jews and Christians. I really believe it. That's very hard to do. It's very hard to do, but it's there, you know. Kernel is there, just as the kernel of truth is with the new historians. And we've got to get people to read it and to think about it.
To get back to their religious core, I think, in a way, yeah.
Martin. There's an interesting, and I always hesitate to get into text, because we all read text to some degree selectively. But in response to those who say, look at the Bible, look at the Torah, it's very clear, God promised us this land. And they don't want to read, it clearly says that, but they don't want to go on to the fact that in virtually every case where the Torah says that God promises the land, there's a conditional aspect to it. If you take care of, you know, in the prophets, the needy, the orphan, the widow, if you treat the stranger as you treat yourself, then I give you this land. And they don't want to look at that. If we're going to root what we're saying in this kind of religious, we have to look at it in terms of what the spiritual and prophetic tradition really says about this.
And nowhere that I know of does God say, I'm going to give it to you and to no one else.
Exactly.
I mean, there were Semitic tribes all through that region, and there are Semitic tribes today all through that region, and some are Jewish and some are Arab, and they are Semitic tribes, and this is their land. And I think, you know, reading the Old Testament, if you know, my understanding of a just God is that he gives us what we need. He gives us the land, but not necessarily just for us, because we have neighbors and we have the guy next door and we have the tribe next door and we have whatever. And that's such a misreading, I think, of the Old Testament. Say, well, God gave us this land. And I just want to say, well, that may be true, but he also gave it to the Arabs. He also gave it because there's a Semitic tribe in the next tent.
Right.
You know, that has a right to this land.
It's not conditional.
One of the
unconditional, I mean, sorry.
One of the pieces that is always referred to, next to Jerusalem, but almost as much as Jerusalem and more than any place else, the hotbed is Hebron for all sorts of reasons. And what you will hear all the time and what I once upon a time taught is the section in the Bible that talks about Abraham buying that land. And I wish we had time to go into it, but it specifies specifically what the borders are, and the negotiations are fascinating because Abraham basically doesn't negotiate, and the rabbis tell us that so that there would be no question. He didn't want to bring the price down because nobody could ever said you cheated us or whatever. And it's like a deed, and there's the proof that we own this land. And what we never dealt with, and it was like a revelation to me as I got into this and, you know, dealt on that level, is the first question of why did Abraham have to buy that land? He had to buy the land because it belonged to somebody else, and he only bought part of it. And it's an incredibly complex situation of exactly that, that God can promise. You know, we talk about the Jews being chosen people. Go look at the text and see what he does with Isaac and with Ishmael. And, yeah, God chooses a lot of people. And we just would like to, we Jews, some of us, would like to just forget about that and say, well, mm-hmm. look what it says here. Right. God says it's ours.
What's interesting, it seems like this whole, to me, it seems like the whole conflict is less about religion at all. It's all, like you said, it's all about land. It's all about land. Yeah. But in some ways, you guys are actually saying some of the getting – one of the solutions is to go back to the scriptures and actually read it for what it is and maybe kind of look at it that way. In a way, I mean, in some way.
No, you say, you know, it isn't about religion. It's about land, which is right.
Right.
But it's justified with religious arguments.
Which is
and
the
I think
which
we, that's what we have to puncture. You know, so, God gave us this land 2,000 years ago. Well – you know, that isn't the end of the story.
Isn't that always what institutions do? Is they use religion to justify their actions?
That's right.
Yeah,
read into it what you want to read into it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, what do we do to stop that? I guess we go back. What do we do to stop that justification?
Well, you know, I mean, there aren't enough of us doing this.
That's why you're here.
Yeah.
But we compensate for the huge amounts of money we have.
Yes, right. But, we do see some inroads into the institute, into what's happening. And we do see people beginning to see the light to some extent. Mm-hmm. And there is organizing going on around this. And the whole boycott, defacement, sanctions issue is being seen by a lot of people as a nonviolent way to resist the occupation. And that call came from Palestine. Mm. And I think that's a tough issue. It's a tough issue. But those of us sort of working on it, the thing we see is kind of the fear on the part of the Israeli institutions about this. They're very, very touchy, about boycott and divestment. And when you talk about that, and
because it can work,
yeah,
partly.
and so there is pushback, and there is pushback here. There's pushback, you know, in Europe. It ebbs and flows to some extent, but I have to believe, you know, Martin Luther King says, you know, the arc of justice, the arc bends.
Is long, you know, but ends towards justice.
Thank you. I couldn't do that. Didn't know how to get out of it. And when I spoke with Palestinian refugees, I was in Lebanon and Syria in 2004, and we would always ask the same question of, now these are people that have been, you know, literally generations in refugee camps. What is your vision? What is your vision? Because they do have a vision that they will share this land. And they talk about 50 years, 60 years. They have, you know, we tend, you know, I tend to want something to happen, you know,
yesterday,
know, next week, right. or the Congress, to, you know, whatever. And I really now, I've changed. I know I'm not going to probably live to see much of a change. Mm-hmm. But I got to believe that, you know, reading history and looking at that justice is going to prevail in some way, because frankly, Israel is a siege state. It can't continue this way. You can't have half your population under occupation and have any kind of society that's worth living in. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of people in Israel that understand that, but the government doesn't. And the government in Israel has always been the warriors, has always been the military people, hasn't been the statesmen. And they're calling the shots. But at some point, there has to be fatigue, or somewhere this whole thing has to begin to collapse from the demographics, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, as I say, I'm not sure I'm going to live to see it.
It may be, and I know this may sound strange, but it may be that the best ally that we have right now is Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm using him as kind of a symbol for broader Israel leadership. And I talked earlier about how he reflects what Sharon was so good at in pushing, and then pulling back a little. The Israeli government has now pushed to a point where the world can't ignore the way it, to a large extent, has. And for a long time, it was incredible controversy as to whether you could use the word apartheid. And now it's used mm-hmm. openly.
Yeah.
Ehud Olmert, a certainly not lefty, said, if we don't change the policy, we're going to be an apartheid state. This business that Israel contends it wants to be a Jewish and democratic state, it's just not possible anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to choose one. I mean, it can be a democratic state with a very inherent Jewish character, along with Arab, Muslim, Palestinian sensibilities. But that's not where it's going right now. Where it's
right.
going is, and pushed by secular Jews, a good part of them are not religious Jews. These are right-wing secular Jews
mm-hmm.
Who are saying Jewish precludes, you know, it takes precedence over democratic. And some of the laws that have been passed or are being considered they become so fascist that there are Israelis in the media and in the political system that are actually using that word.
Oh, yeah.
Saying...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, in fact, Jeff Halper, who we both know, who heads the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, because there's just every day there are houses Palestinian
right.
houses demolished because they don't have the license, or they're in the way, or they're in a military zone, or they blew their nose, whatever.
Because yeah. We need the land.
Yeah,
right.
And. But he says, you know, they have they talk about separation. They talk about the wall as the separation wall. Hafradah, is that the Hebrew word?
Yep.
And they use that word a lot. Now, people blanch when they talk about Israel being an apartheid society. But if you look at the UN protocols for apartheid,
mm-hmm.
and you look at a society where 20% of the population in Israel proper are Palestinian or Arab, they go to separate schools, they're driven out of their homes and into ghettos, even if they have a home in a particular area that Israel wants to take over. They're driven out. They're driven into ghettos. They cannot serve. There's certain things they can't do. Cannot serve in the military. And if you don't serve in the military, then there's all kinds of benefits that you don't get. It's so that you look at that society, and even South Africans look at it and say, not only is this classic apartheid, but this is worse than South Africa.
Wow.
So there you have it.
It's a great, wow. That's So I guess the next thing is how do we get this out there? How do we get again talking about? I guess this is more getting the message across. Is this the best way to kind of get defeat this beast?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we certainly try to get ourselves in any place where we can talk and anyone will hear us. That's not going real well. There are demonstrations and making it uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
There is the BDS movement. There is the constant, I think,
What's the BDS movement?
Oh, I'm sorry. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
Right. Okay. Sorry.
You know, that keeps putting the issue out,
mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I think it's that kind of pushing in terms of dealing with the Congress right now. It's, you know, there's a lock on Congress. They won't even talk about it. You can't run for Congress and say as Governor Dean of Vermont, you know, he tried to talk about a balanced approach and he was absolutely massacred. So you can't use words like that even and run for Congress. But we've got to change that kind of climate. You can talk about this issue easier in Israel than you
really?
Can in the United States.
Hmm.
And I had a friend who's lives in Israel, and she came over here. She was studying at Lesley. Her husband has left Israel. He lives here all the time, but she's got friends, so she goes back every once in a while. And I talked to her about this. I said, because she goes to a synagogue, and I said, you know, do you talk about it in the synagogue? She said, you know, I can't talk about it in the synagogue. I can at home, in the synagogue, in the marketplace, whatever. We can talk about it, but here, you cannot even talk about it. In at least in her particular synagogue, and she said it is unbelievable the kind of lockdown we mm-hmm. have even on dialogue on this issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are some cracks. There are a couple of groups that are very consciously more moderate that have been able to get some discussion under certain circumstances. And I hope that will go on. J Street, for instance, which I have problems with, they are obsessively two-state, and this two-state solution is dead.
They aren't AIPAC.
but they're giving an alternative, and they're able to get in a some level of discussion into places that some of us, JVP, AJJP, have not been able to for a long time. But overwhelmingly, it's true. I mean, I go to a congregation that is particularly progressive. We have a social action committee that is universally against the occupation, supportive of Palestinians. And we have had discussion. But even in our congregation, when we cross the line, when we go to a certain point, you can't do that.
Yeah.
That's just not what we do. And we certainly, and this I have echoes from my father, it's bad enough to criticize. You know, we don't criticize Israel because we're here and they're there and, we don't have a right. But the absolute cardinal sin is we don't do that discussion in front of them. So to have these discussions in a way and in the most offensive way, you don't talk about these kinds of things where the goyim can hear you.
Mm-hmm.
And it locks it down in so many places. Mm-hmm. I have been thrown out of synagogues at open presentations. I once went to a place where somebody was talking about giving all of the things in the Quran that were negative about Jews or non-Muslims and whatever. And I got up not to counteract it, but just to say, we have to be aware. I'm not sure you would like to hear somebody standing up and talking about all the passages in the Torah that are equally offensive. And I was shouted down and escorted out. It's not, you can't even talk about it.
Yeah.
Mm. That's sad. I mean, it really is. How we can't have the dialogue in that sense, and there's no mm-hmm. sense of, there's no communication there.
But I want to reiterate, there have been some cracks,
mm-hmm.
Not enough to totally do away with my growing pessimism, the reality, because there's so much mm-hmm. to do, and I've had speaking engagements where there was real conversation and people that asked questions that clearly showed, boy, I didn't know that. Tell me more about this. And I walk out feeling really wonderful. And I have to remind myself, there were 25 people there, and there's millions of basically just normal Jews out there that still carry the myths with them.
So how do we get to the cracks and expose them, make them larger? Is it working more and more with Palestinian groups, or working getting hear their voices more, or is it more about, you know, other Jews as well, like actually saying the stuff that we need to be saying in conversation, where it shouldn't be said, but you know, where we need to say it?
Well, I'm very encouraged, frankly, by the existence and the growth of Jewish Voice for Peace, because I think it's so incredibly important that the country begin to see that the Jews are not monolith. It's not a monolith.
Right.
You know, there's a great there's dissent. I mean, most of the people I work with on this issue are Jews, you know, that share this vision and that understand the prophets. Anyway, I just think that the visibility of a growing organization that's witnessing to what I think is what Jews are, you know, should be all about in terms of their faithfulness to their, you know, to their roots. And I, you know, when you see when there's a demonstration against, say, the AIPAC, which is the
American-Israel Public Relations Committee.
It is a huge lobby.
Yes.
It's Jewish lobby. Yes. Huge right-wing lobby. And when we go out at times when they have a dinner, big dinner here, and there's a demonstration, what really gets to them is when they see Jews out there. You know, that really, you know, because, you know, it's like the prophet before the king. They don't want to deal with these people.
Right.
Who deep down in their heart they think maybe right about this thing. That's encouraging. And I hope that organization, and I hope there's many more like it, because I think the visibility of the of cracks in the Jewish community is the most important thing that can happen right at this point.
And the other aspect of that is that what is spurring, not only but particularly Jewish Voice for Peace right now, are the young people. It's amazing.
Yes.
And I look at, and it's affecting us here, Hebrew College, which is historically moderate theologically, but has pretty much been conservative politically, partly because of leadership, partly because there are so many Israelis that teach there, started a rabbinical program a couple of years ago. And I have been amazed. It took me a while to be able to connect with some of these people. By and large, all of these young people, a number of whom have now graduated and become rabbis, are incredibly active against the occupation. The current chair of the newly re-established JVP chapter here is a young rabbi who has a congregation, and it has been an incredible battle to find rabbis, even those who kind of agree with you, having the courage to stand up and risk their contracts and their relations with others to question Israel at all. And these young people are coming along, and they're standing out and speaking. And if there's something that encourages me, that's what encourages
me. And this really resonated with Occupy. When we went down, we had several engagements, you know, when there was the encampment. And we went down, and we would leaflet, and we would speak. We had a big rally at one point, and some of us spoke, and there were just – but the message of justice, we had, you know, young people saying, geez, I didn't really know this is going on. I didn't know it was this – whatever. And the response on the part of young people and the part of the Occupy people who are all about justice and equity and that kind of thing, boy, it really resonated. And, you know, I really got a lot of encouragement from our dealings with the Occupy folk.
That's great. That's a great note to end on, actually. Yeah. I want to thank you both for being here, especially talking about, you know, well, let's kind of make sure, crack the narrative, really resist the bullying, and hope for the young people. I want to thank you all for being here, John Roberts. Your show this week in Palestine on 8 a.m. Sunday morning, 8 a.m. WZBC at 90.3 FM. Working with the Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights, Martin Fetterman on Jewish Voice for Peace in Boston, and the American Jews for Just Peace in Boston. Thank you for being here. Thank you both for being here and going over this with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. And if I can take a 10-minute sales, go to ajjpboston.org or jvpboston.org.
Thank you both. And thank you for listening. This is Diego Concepcion, Theology in Action. Good night, and thank you very much for listening.